On behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'm Chuck Frankel, your moderator tonight. It's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest. Peter Godwin was born and raised in Africa. He studied law at Cambridge University and international relations at Oxford. He's an award-winning foreign correspondent, author, documentary maker, and screenwriter. After practicing human rights law in Zimbabwe, he became a foreign and war correspondent and has reported from over 60 countries, including wars in Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, Zimbabwe, Uganda, Somalia, Congo, Ivory Coast, Sudan, Bosnia, Kosovo, Kashmir, and the last years of apartheid in South Africa. He served as East European correspondent and diplomatic correspondent for London Sunday Times and chief correspondent for BBC's television flagship foreign affairs program. He's the author of 5 nonfiction books and a recipient of the George Orwell Prize, the Esquire Apple Waterstones Award, and the Borders Original Voices Award. He's a 2010 Guggenheim Fellow, and he's taught writing at the New School, Princeton, and Columbia. He's here tonight to discuss his newest work, The Fear, Robert Mugabe and the Martyrdom of Zimbabwe. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Peter Godwin. Mr. Godwin, welcome to the program tonight. I'd appreciate it if you could give us a little background to set the stage for discussing your book. If you would, talk about Zimbabwe or Rhodesia around 1980. How did Zimbabwe come into existence?
I mean, the main thing about Zimbabwe as it came into existence as an independent country in 1980 was that it had just come out of 7 years of a very intensive civil war, really since 1972. And it was, as a nation, it was exhausted. It's probably worth comparing what the white settler state of Rhodesia was like as opposed to South Africa. They were both systems that were based on race, but they differed somewhat in degree. I think it's fair to say that the wounds of apartheid in South Africa, and I call them wounds deliberately rather than scars, because to call them scars would be to imply that they might have healed, were much deeper. They were, for one thing, had gone on for much longer. Apartheid had gone on for much longer. But it was also a much more hermetic system, and it was somewhat more brutal in its application. The Bantu Education Act, for example, in South Africa, was a particularly invidious piece of legislation that deliberately set out to deliberately deprive black Africans of education and to keep them deliberately undereducated. Now, in Zimbabwe, there was institutionalized, in Rhodesia, there was institutionalized racism, but it there was also a civil war, fully fledged civil war. I mean, it was a bush war, an insurgency war, and it left by the end, calculations are hard to be exact, but probably about 35 or 40,000 people died. Most of them, the overwhelming number of them, were black civilians who were caught in between the Rhodesian security forces and the two different, there were two opposing liberation movements. Robert Mugabe's ZANLA, which was part of his party, ZANU, and Joshua Nkomo's ZIPRA, which is part of his party, ZAPU. And at independence, what had happened was, just towards the very end, the white Rhodesians had made a deal with a more moderate black nationalist leader called Bishop Muzorewa. And for about 2 years, there was a sort of an ill-fated transitional state called, everything about it was hyphenated, including its name. It was called Zimbabwe Rhodesia. And it wasn't internationally recognized. And then there was the Lancaster House Peace Agreement in late 1979, which led to this their first free and fair multi-party election. And it's worth remembering that at the time, the belief, certainly in the West, was that Mugabe wouldn't win that election. It was thought that Muzorewa, a combination of Muzorewa and Nkomo, and then there were going to be 20 white seats reserved for the white minority, that some electoral combination of that would win the day. And in fact, what happened was that Mugabe's ZANU party swept the board. I mean, they got something like 57 seats in the which was a majority in that first 100 seat election. So it was with enormous consternation that the whites, in particular, greeted the victory of Mugabe. They had fed themselves a diet of propaganda that told them that Mugabe was a communist, that he would nationalize everything, that he was in fact supported by China, not Soviet Union. Bear in mind, this was 1980, so we were still in the middle of the Cold War. They got ready to leave the country, those who were still there, especially the farmers, thought their goose was well and truly cooked. And when Mugabe took power, in fact, he delivered, it's interesting, we forget it now, but he delivered a kind of precursor of what Mandela did 13 years later. He made this amazingly reconciliatory speech, and in particular, he didn't have any sort of racial vendetta. He seemed very magnanimous, and in particular, he reached out to the white commercial farmers who ran in industrialized agriculture, basically, and said to them that if they wanted to contribute to the new Zimbabwe, what they should do is stay, go back to their farms, and feed not only Zimbabwe but the nation. So most of them did exactly that. And so, in fact, you know, if you were to take a snapshot of Zimbabwe in the early 1980s. It was a sort of prototype of the Rainbow Nation. And people like me, I came from what were then known as a white liberal family. We all went back, that we were all going to contribute to the new Zimbabwe and show the world that we could establish a multiracial nation and that we could get past the divisions of the past and create something. Now, it's also important to note that what was inherited by Mugabe wasn't just a sort of wasn't a war-shattered nation in the way that we imagine it. If we look at Somalia or Sudan or, you know, these other African nations which have been ravaged by war. In fact, Mugabe inherited a very robust infrastructure, a country that if you for those of you who've been there, I mean, will know this, but I mean, when you arrived in Zimbabwe, you in some senses couldn't believe you were in Africa. The infrastructure was very, very advanced. And very quickly, Zimbabwe established one of the highest GDPs in Africa. It had the highest literacy rate within a very few years, one of Mugabe's conspicuous successes. So he built on that infrastructure, in terms of health and education and you know, general services, it was an extremely impressive nation.
And how did we get from there to here? How did Mugabe then establish his power?
Well, this is where, in all honesty, what I need to do is to just tell you very briefly what the conventional wisdom is before I present my own views as being the conventional wisdom, which they're not. So the conventional wisdom, I mean, if this were a Hollywood drama, the sort of the arc of the plot or the narrative, the trajectory would be that Mugabe comes in, we think he's going to be the devil incarnate because basically we're sort of hoist on our own propaganda. He turns out to be, you know, he's a very, very educated man, a man with, I think, 6 postgraduate degrees, extremely articulate in several languages, a trained lawyer, Jesuit educated, and that what happens essentially is that He comes in, he rules very well, he's magnanimous, the country is an enormous success, and this goes on for some time. And then suddenly, sort of in the late 1990s, towards the late 1990s, he has a sudden rush of blood to the head. By then his wife, his Ghanaian wife Sally, who was on kidney dialysis for the last, I think, 5 or 6 years of her life, had died. And he had acquired a much, much younger wife, I think 35 years younger than him, known unaffectionately by Zimbabweans as the first shopper for her for her consumer retail appetite. And that he'd gone from not being personally corrupt at all. He's rather a sort of, he doesn't really drink, and he's a devotee of cricket. Thinks that, you know, he's clearly also an Anglophile, that he towards the sort of late 1990s undergoes the sort of metamorphosis, and things start to go wrong very quickly. Now, the problem with that, and then he invades he sends his militia onto the white farms. They seize all those farms. Agriculture collapses. The economy unravels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what precipitated this? I mean, in actual fact, what happens is that in 1999, Mugabe has run out of term. In other words, he faces term limits as president. I live in New York, a bit like our mayor did, and he dealt with those too. So what Mugabe needed to do was change the constitution, which he was obliged to have a referendum in order to do. Now, as a footnote to this, you know, everybody thinks Mugabe's a dictator, et cetera, et cetera, but how come he has elections? Well, he has these periodic elections because he's a rather fastidious authoritarian figure. He's not like others. So you have had elections in Zimbabwe, but they haven't always been free and fair. But this particular one was a referendum which he thought he would win very easily, and was absolutely shocked and horrified when he lost it, and basically reacted in an absolute fury. And went onto the farms and did, you know, attacked the opposition and began the spiral, which was the sort of death dive of Zimbabwe into failed state. So here we are 11 years later, and it was the fastest contracting economy in history and various things. But going back to that trajectory, where that doesn't quite work for me was that in the early 80s, when I was just starting out as a sort of rookie reporter, they were having trouble in the south of the country. I mean, the bit that borders Botswana, in fact, with Joshua Nkomo's followers who were being restive. And there was a small security problem in one area of it. And so Robert Mugabe sent his North Korean-trained 5th Brigade to sort it out. And they went down into the south of the country. The Matabele make up roughly 20% of the population, and they live in the southwest of the country. This brigade went down, and to the best of our knowledge, they killed 20,000 civilians in a fairly short period of time. I mean, it was a sort of, it was a cultural genocide, if not a complete one. And nobody's ever been arrested for it, and nothing much happened. Nobody, you know, Mugabe wasn't hauled up before the UN. This started in late 83 and went on to 84, and eventually Joshua Nkomo, his party ZAPU, which was supported by the Southerners, was so bludgeoned that they were co-opted into a sort of unity accord in the mid-80s. And then Zimbabwe effectively became a one-party state until that referendum in 1999. So my contention is that essentially Mugabe, you can't do that good leader turns bad. That Mugabe's default is that he reacts to opposition, his default is to react to opposition violently. And whatever you think of the liberation war, I mean, morally justified or not, and most people think it probably was at this stage, that what it is tactically is a violent response to, you know, you reach a point where you're not getting anywhere, so you militarize, which is what happened. And you can sort of see the train of thought. It works for you then, and therefore it becomes your default sort of fallback position. So that's, you know, that's where I see the DNA of it.
And you mentioned the Liberation War, which causes me to ask you, his role in the Liberation War is very significant in terms of his standing among his colleagues in Africa.
Yes, I mean his role as a liberation leader. I mean, Robert Mugabe was never a soldier as such, and in fact, it's worth just noting that there was a very very his general in chief of the guerrillas was a very popular leader called Josiah Tongogara, who died under somewhat mysterious circumstances very shortly after independence. Mugabe was the sort of political leader, but he was absolutely this kind of liberation hero across, you know, a pan-African liberation hero. And he was a kind of colossus as such, astride the African stage. And it's interesting that when Nelson Mandela is finally released in 1990, that if you look at the footage, some of the early footage of Mugabe, you know, with Mandela, you can see that Mugabe's kind of annoyed. I mean, he's sort of, you know, he can see him, he feels like he's being shoved aside as Mandela comes out. And when I interviewed Mandela, I mean, it's funny, he has this joke where he says, Mugabe was the star and then the sun came out. so there's a sort of element of, you know, that Mugabe was slightly peeved at being sort of elbowed out of number one position there. But your point is well taken insofar as if you have a revolutionary leader like Mugabe, and if you have a liberation war like you had in Zimbabwe, you create the circumstances whereby dictatorship becomes very probable, in fact. I mean, you see Mugabe has this kind of messianic feel to him, that basically he feels like he liberated the people, and therefore, you know, I've been in other dictatorships which have had similar situations, like Cuba, for example, and Cuba feels very similar in the sense that in Zimbabwe and in Cuba, you feel like the revolution happened early last week. You know, it's constantly brought up, it's constantly referred to, and that nobody who wasn't part of the revolution has any political legitimacy. They're not allowed to be, you know, taken seriously politically or to establish opposition parties or whatever. And that's what happens in Zimbabwe increasingly. And I think that was finally challenged in 1999 for the first time. But he does still, and he himself, you know, goes back to the war, refers to it all the time.
So in 2008, to jump ahead, there was another election, and it was an election which appeared very soon to be lost by Mugabe. It appeared that his opponent, Tsvangirai, was very likely to win, even though there was tremendous complete control of the election by Mugabe. And then you, who had not been living in Zimbabwe for some time but had visited there, decided that it was time to go back. What caused you to do that? You were not exactly welcome, as I recall.
It wasn't as reckless as it sounds. I mean, what had happened, just spinning back to my own resume, it reminds me of that. Was it Woody Allen who said, "Enough about me, what do you think about me?" I don't mean to keep inserting myself into the story, but essentially after the Matabeleland massacres, which I had written about, I got thrown out of Zimbabwe and there were death threats. They tried to kill me and blah, 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 and I left. But in 1985, 86, with this unity pact with the then opposition, Nkomo's party, happened, the person who was appointed as the Home Affairs Minister was one of those I had defended as a human rights lawyer. And so he gave me some guarantees. He said, you know, if you come back, I can protect you while you're here, as long as you don't write stuff while you're here. So I had gone in and out of it, and my parents were still living there. And as as Zimbabwe spiraled into this sort of failed statehood. And it's worth bearing in mind just how bad things got from late 99, 2000 when it started. Economists believe it's been the fastest contracting economy, peacetime economy in history. It went into a very, very steep dive. And one of the main problems was that it suffered from rampant hyperinflation that got so bad that by the end, the Zimbabwe dollar was halving every 24 hours. So you basically couldn't be liquid at all. And it's amazing how difficult it is it became a barter economy. It wasn't really liquid, but people were still being civil servants and people were still being paid in Zimbabwe dollars that became instantly kind of, you know, almost worthless. I mean, they used to laugh because at the main golf course in Harare, Zimbabwe has very good golf courses still, that there's an 18-hole golf course there and that the golfers would habitually go to the bar at the end of 18. But what they would do now with hyperinflation is that they go to the bar first and try and work out how many drinks they want and pay for all of them, because by the time they'd done 18 holes, the drinks would have doubled in price. So it was preemptive kind of drinking. Think that things had got so bad that Zimbabweans. By Zimbabweans, I mean principally black Zimbabweans, by the way. There were, you know, by this stage, very, very few whites left in Zimbabwe. At the height of Rhodesia stroke Zimbabwe, there were never more than, the white population never quite reached 300,000. I think probably around 275,000 was as many as it got.
Out of how many?
Out of, I mean, then probably 10 million total population. So it was tiny, very, very small. Now I would be surprised if there were more than, officially people say there are 40,000. I would be surprised if there were more than 20,000. And many of them are very elderly. The white population to all intents and purposes is being reduced to the expat, expat levels. But the black population, things had got so bad, and hyperinflation was really the main thing. The 10,000 white farms had been taken, and that had collapsed agriculture. But for most Zimbabweans, life had become, their standard of living had gone down to pre-1950 levels. Their lifespan had, average lifespan had decreased from almost 60 to about 35. And that was a cocktail, a toxic cocktail of AIDS, starvation, very low nutrition rate, collapsed healthcare system. Education system had collapsed completely because the teachers weren't being paid and, government had effectively stopped. So that had collapsed as well. In 2008, that was the climate. And there's this survey they do every year, which attempts to kind of monitor the happiness of peoples around the world. And whatever you think of it, it is consistent year on year. They kind of ask the same questions and whatever. And Zimbabwe came last in that. It was officially the unhappiest nation on earth. It had the highest ratio of orphans of any country in the world. I mean, it had a bunch of superlatives and none of them were good. And so in 2008, Mugabe has to have an election. Now, as I said, he's an oddly fastidious dictator. He wants the window dressing of democracy. It's very important to his self-image as a liberator. He doesn't want to look into the mirror and see Idi Amin looking back at him. He's a much more, cultivated man who worries about his international image, especially on the African stage. But there are ways he wins elections are many. I mean, there's straight intimidation, and some of the things that he does are fairly basic because he controls the counting, and he who controls the counting controls the elections, and there are really no checks and balances over that. So some of the things that I saw and some at the time, you know, I mean, they would add a zero to their, you know, their, I mean, nothing particularly sophisticated, or simply swap the results, you know, between the MDC, the opposition party, and their party. So, but there were a few little concessions that had been brokered, because by now Mugabe was coming under increasing regional and international pressure. There were a few little concessions that the opposition managed to get. One of them, I think, snuck by without anybody noticing the implications of it. And that was that there were about 9,000 polling stations throughout the country, many of them in very inaccessible rural areas, where it took sort of days to get results back. The opposition managed to insert some little clause in the legislation that meant that you had to stick up the results in each polling station on the wall once you'd counted them. And what they did was they imported 9,000 of those little plastic disposable cameras that, you know, you see scattered around in wedding receptions, and people take pictures of each other when they've had too much to drink, put them on YouTube or something. And they got their election agents to snap shots of those raw figures, which suddenly boxed ZANU-PF in, because if you had those pictures, you couldn't then, you know, give alternate. So very quickly they realized what was going on, and they chased the opposition election agents away, and they stomped on the cameras and whatever. But enough of them survived for them to, you know, not to be able to cheat as effectively as before. So the way the system worked was that there was Mugabe was up against Morgan Tsvangirai, who is the leader of the opposition of the Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC. But if neither of them got over 50% in that first round, it would go to a second round. So they had the first round, and Mugabe just wouldn't announce it. And he wouldn't announce it, and he wouldn't announce it. And it became clear from everything we were hearing that he'd lost, and lost quite badly. And they were basically trying to decide what the hell to do about it now, you know, what would they do? And for a dizzying moment in Harare, for about 2 weeks, it looked like, by then, bear in mind, he was 84, it looked like he'd suddenly kind of, you know, he was suddenly deflated, and the size of the rejection was so great that, you know, he just thought, you know what, it's enough now, I'll hand it over.
Wanted to go back to celebrate.
Right, and so I was, you know, in that moment, I got a commission from magazine, from Vanity Fair, who said, you know, go and dance on Mugabe's political grave, and I said, with pleasure. So I jumped up, and there were foreign correspondents in at the time, you know, things looked like they were just unraveling very quickly. So I went back in that moment. And when I arrived in Harare, there was an amazing, a sort of giddy feeling of expectation that, you know, after, you know, after essentially nearly 30 years of this, of essentially one party rule, it was about to be over. There were very serious negotiations taking place, which a number of foreign embassies, including the American embassy, were involved in trying to facilitate, which were brokering exit packages, exit deals for Mugabe and his generals. And they were pondering them and looked pretty likely to take them. But yet still the results didn't come out, And I was waiting in Harare, and my younger sister, Georgina, had joined me, and we were waiting, and nothing would happen. Nothing was happening, I think. So we decided to take a road trip back out to the east of Zimbabwe, where we grew up, a place called Chimanimani, which is on the Mozambique border. And there's this beautiful, lush, verdant, mountainous area that shatters any preconceived cliche you might have of what Africa looks like, sort of dusty plains of the savannah and whatever. It has orchards and dairy cattle and whatever. It feels almost more alpine in some ways. So we went there, and there was oddly a little music festival there, and we went there and we walked in the mountains and various things. And on our way back, we started to see, usually at twilight, people off to the side of the road being pushed in wheelbarrows. And Georgina made some little remark about, you know, public transport being so bad that you couldn't hail a taxi anymore, you had to hail a wheelbarrow. And by the time we got back to Harare, what I later realized, to my shame, was that those were the first torture victims being wheeled back from the torture centers to their homes. Now, So what had actually happened was that Mugabe had met with his Politburo, and before that he'd met with the generals, with a sort of, you know, a smaller number of people, and they'd come very, you know, he'd said, I think, I mean, I wasn't in the room, but I knew people who were, that he was thinking of standing down, and they said, no, it's not just about you, it's about all of us, and we can't, you know, we're not going to do it. And then, you know, this is what we're going to do instead, is that we will say that we'll concede and say that Morgan Tsvangirai got more votes than you but didn't clear the 50%, and we'll go to a second round. And between now and that second round, we will go, we'll send the soldiers and the militia and everybody out into the field. And basically what they did was they launched, at that point they threw out all the foreign correspondents. Nearly all the opposition leaders fled the country because their lives were in danger. The NGOs were essentially closed down, and they couldn't go out into the field. They were all told to stay in base. So they kind of closed the country down, and then they sent these. They turned the abandoned schools, ironically, into torture bases, and they went and they had party lists, opposition party lists, and they fanned out and they picked up the opposition office bearers at quite, you know, lowly levels, village and you know, provincial levels, and they brought them into the schools and they tortured them, and they tortured them in such a there was such a pattern to it. It was absolutely, you know, when I started sneaking to hospitals and interviewing these people, you know, there was an absolute pattern. They would beat them very, very severely. They would break their, you know, having already burnt down their houses, and you know, they killed hundreds of people in the process, burning houses and killing livestock and one thing or another, taking these people, mass raping the women, many thousands of women raped, and nearly all of whom subsequently contracted AIDS, HIV, and they then, but they didn't, the people who were in the torture bases, who were taken in the torture bases, by and large, they didn't kill them. Some died, but by and large, the plan was you very, very severely tortured these people. And then these were the people going in the wheelbarrows, being pushed home. But the idea was that these people would become human billboards. They would be advertisements for what happens if you opposed Mugabe. And they went back to their communities, and they, when they arrived and the people saw them, they kind of, you know, spread these ripples of anxiety. And it got so bad that ultimately the opposition, Morgan Tsvangirai, pulled out of that next round because just too many people were being killed. That's how bad it got.
So he pulled out, and obviously he was the victor, and there was essentially a standoff. But there was going to be another election to determine who is the winner. And was there an election, and was it recognized?
Yes, I mean, there was an election, but Tsvangirai had said that he wasn't standing, but his name was on the ballot paper technically, but he told his people not even to bother, and Mugabe then declared himself the winner by some large majority, but nobody recognized it initially. Various African countries did, but the international community didn't, and certain African countries also were hesitant. And ultimately what has happened is that the regional organization SADC, the Southern African Development Community, got together and brokered a kind of deal, which was called the Global Political Agreement, which has laid down the basis for a so-called government of national unity, although it's not really united at all, whereby the opposition has been sort of has been brought into this transitional government, and the idea being that they would rule together for a period of about 2 years, during which a whole raft of reforms would be brought in, electoral and all sorts of other things, and it would lead up to a real free and fair elections. Now, what's actually happened is that, and so there are opposition members now in the cabinet, for example. This has been going on for about 2 years now with very mixed results. The success the successes have been almost entirely economic, and they all, almost all they al- almost all come to what down to one thing, which is the abandonment of the Zimbabwe dollar. So they abandoned the Zimbabwe dollar, which was, you know, worth, I think the last, I've got some of them at home, the last note I think was a $100 trillion note. I think, is it 100 trillion? 100, yeah. Which I'm really annoyed because I had a bunch of them at one point, and apparently you can sell them for about $20 on eBay now, which is way more than they were worth when they actually were real money. So they simply abandoned the currency, and they've gone to the US dollar. And so you can actually pay people, and you can run businesses and whatever. You have a currency, although you can't, because you don't print your own money, you don't have control over your monetary policy in that sense. The dollar is just worth what the dollar is worth. So Zimbabwe has become very expensive. But to diplomats and tourists and people going through, they say it's great because there's stuff in the stores again, and it's all, of course, it's nearly all imported now. Most of it comes from South Africa or from China. But for your average black Zimbabwean, the stores may be full, but they can't really afford what's in there. Although I think that they are slightly better off. I mean, Zimbabwe was in a kind of death dive, and it sort of pulled out just before it hit the bottom and is skittering along. But there's been no political resolution at all. So these two parties sit in, you know, they sit in the same cabinet room, and they meet once a week with Mugabe, and yet, you know, half the opposition people have been tortured by the other people that they're with in the same room. So it's a very curious situation, and these promised reforms have mostly not materialized.
And there continue to be arrests and tortures.
Right, and now the situation, I mean, in fact, it's very fluid because it's just moved in the last 2 days, is what's happened is that Mugabe was saying, well, he wants elections very soon. I mean, literally in the next few months. And whenever he announces that there'll be elections, there's an uptick in violence. And that's what's been happening in the last couple of months. They've increased the number of arrests, and they've increased the number of beatings. And I mean, one of the arrests, funnily enough, I mean, not to anticipate a question, but was a group of people led by a university academic, who because they didn't have satellite TV, had taped, you know, CNN's coverage of the Arab Spring. You know, by then it was Libya hadn't yet happened. It was Tunisia and Egypt. And they were all arrested and charged with high treason for watching it. I mean, so you can tell that's, you know, it's a relatively repressive environment still.
Now, how can Tsvangirai stay in a cabinet like that? How can he serve with Mugabe when his people are being abducted, tortured?
Well, the rate of violence has got worse recently, but it's nothing like it was, you know, in the events that I'm describing in the book in 2008, where, I mean, they were calling it, you know, politicide rather than genocide. But I mean, it you know, one of my purposes in writing the book is to show that it was done so systematically and so hierarchically. That it rose to the level of crimes against humanity, which is the opinion of many international lawyers, and I think, including you'll find soon, many of the prosecutors at the International Court of Criminal Justice. I mean, I think that's part of the problem, in a sense that's one of the reasons that when Mugabe had his meeting with the generals and said, you know, maybe it's time to throw in the towel, they, you know, they say, well, you know, we're going to end up like Charles Taylor in The Hague. You know, we'll, you know, that whatever the Zimbabwean opposition promised them in terms of immunity from prosecution, it's not like that anymore. The international legal system is changing, and it's still very amorphous, and it's moving, and it's early days, but, you know, it be a situation where they might yet be prosecuted. And I think one of the problems with Zimbabwe, you know, one of the reasons that we have this violent default to political opposition is that over the course of, you know, I mean, over the course of its entire history, going back to white occupation number four, there's been a culture of impunity, that when people do these kind of things, they don't get punished for them. And after, you know, both after the Rhodesian Civil War, after Gukurahundi, these massacres in the early 80s, and after the fear, the violence in 2008, nobody's arrested, nobody's held accountable, and there's no acknowledgement of what's happened. And I think that what happens then is that you start to metastasize that kind of behavior, and that's what we've been faced with.
You mentioned Egypt and Tunisia. Why is Zimbabwe different than those countries? At one point in your book, you say the state is at war with its own people. We are not armed, they are. Zimbabwe is a war with only one side.
Well, and I think that that's true. And I think one of the main reasons, I feel like Zimbabwe had its uprising and it's got this very big intelligentsia. You know, it's got strong civil society now. It's got, as I said, it's got this very strong educational base. And Zimbabwe isn't a country, you know, it's so funny. I mean, America goes into Iraq or Afghanistan or whatever, and they have to do this nation building or whatever. You go to Afghanistan, people have never been given a vote or whatever. You don't have to, there's no nation building required in Zimbabwe. They've got their own, you know, they've built a nation. They just need, the solution is strikingly simple in the sense that you just need free and fair elections. And then, you know, the country, I think, would rehabilitate very quickly. In the coverage of Tunisia and of Egypt in particular, but and the other Arab Spring nations, what is sometimes underplayed in our kind of giddy excitement at the whole thing, and I think it's worth in passing just saying I get no small amount of pleasure from the knowledge that none of the pundits saw this coming. Nobody said, oh, there's going to be a young secular uprising it was all going to be Islamist and whatever. So don't believe all the pundits. What is sometimes underplayed and is absolutely key to the success of these things is how the security forces react. If the Egyptian army had been of a mind they could have cleared Tahrir Square in 2 hours. There would be a lot of blood and a lot of dead people, but they could have done it, and then they would have had the consequences, whatever. But the key thing is that they didn't, and we don't look at that enough. I mean, we're all interested in the Google engineer and the people running it, and as we should be, but in terms of its success, we need to be as interested in the dynamics that are going on in the security forces, that why do some armies follow orders and fire on their own people and some don't, because that's really key to the fulcrum of change at these particular moments, and that needs as much attention and serious study as does the initial uprisings and who's involved in that and how it happens. But suffice it to say that, you know, if you were doing that in Zimbabwe today, you wouldn't be able to put the stems of your flowers down the barrels of the soldiers, because they would meet bullets, live bullets coming the other way. So, you know, that's, Mugabe has kept his security forces loyal.
You spoke about the white population fleeing from Zimbabwe, but what about the blacks? Hasn't Zimbabwe lost several million people at this point?
There's been an absolutely devastating exodus of black Zimbabweans, and it's an exodus that dwarfs the white one. And it's all the more devastating when you look at who these people are, because they are, they're from all socioeconomic groups, but in particular, they are from the leadership echelon. They are from exactly that echelon who should be leading the opposition. And the thing is that they're so well qualified, the black Zimbabweans, that they just go over the border to South Africa in the first instance, many of them. But many of them have emigrated.
And Botswana,
yeah. Many of them have emigrated, you know, to America, to Australia and New Zealand and Canada and America, and done very well by and large. And I mean, you know, you go to the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, it's run by black Zimbabweans. You go to, you know, there's all sorts of places, they've done very well. And the problem is that the longer they stay out, that diaspora, the less likely they are to come back. And that's, you know, one of the big issues, certainly, is how many of them would go back and when.
So the audience is asking many questions, and I think that the main one is, hasn't this risen to a level that some international organization should enter the fray, and why hasn't it?
I know. I mean, there we are in Cuba. I mean, sorry, Cuba, Libya. And I mean, with too little, too late, or whatever you might think. But we're in there. I mean, I think that it's. I think Zimbabwe has been very unlucky in a number of ways for a number of reasons. I think that it is not deemed strategic by America and other countries because it lacks the two exports that are essential to getting our intervention. And those exports are oil and terrorism. We don't export either oil or Islamic terrorism, so we don't really matter. I think that Zimbabwe is a textbook case of a country where you have a peaceful opposition. And it's worth pointing this out, that from the very beginning, from 1999, when the opposition morphed essentially out of a trade union, the Confederation of Trade Unions movement, it in all its initial meetings and its conferences, from the very beginning it said, we're going to follow the path of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and whatever. We're going to be peaceful. This is going to be a peaceful movement, and they've remained peaceful in the teeth of enormous crackdowns and repression. And if we were really, as an international community, really motivated by what we say we are, by humanitarian issues, then Zimbabwe would certainly have qualified at several points, including in 2008, 2009, for international intervention. As well as not being strategic, though, I think the other thing that plays against us is that the key to solving Zimbabwe is South Africa. If South Africa had the political will to sort the Zimbabwe conflict out, they could do it, really in a matter of weeks, if not months. And there's a precedent for this too, which is that in 1974, there was a coup in Portugal, if you can remember. And as a result, very, very quickly, the Portuguese let go of their... Sorry, there was a revolution in Portugal. The Portuguese let go of their African colonies, in particular Angola and Mozambique. And suddenly, white South Africa lost its sort of buffers. It had this sort of buffer system where it had Mozambique, Rhodesia... Namibia, Southwest Africa, and Angola as a sort of, it lost that. And as a result, it was no point in supporting Rhodesia anymore. And the then South African Prime Minister, John Foster, called Ian Smith up, the white leader in Rhodesia, and said, the gig's up, mate. Make your deal the best you can, and we're done. And Smith wouldn't accept that initially. And so what happened was, the Zimbabweans rely very, very heavily on South Africa for trade, in and out, imports and exports, and for getting stuff as well as the routes. The trains stopped running on time. They developed mechanical issues and various things. And it was made clear to Smith that the gig was up. And so he went and started negotiating, and that brought about independence. So the South Africans have the wherewithal to twist, to squeeze Zimbabwe should they want to, which begs the question, why haven't they, given, for example, that there are, by some estimates, 3 million Zimbabwean refugees in South Africa who are the periodic targets of these terrible xenophobic attacks, among other things. And I think the answer to why the South African, I mean, what has happened, even if you go back to the Bush administration, when George Bush said that, Thabo Mbeki, who was then South African president, was his point man on the Zimbabwe conflict, that it's been an easy conflict to sort of hand off to South Africa and say, you guys sort it out, you're the kind of regional thing. And I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times last week when the Côte d'Ivoire situation finally came to a head, if you remember. And there are many, many parallels between Côte d'Ivoire, between the Ivory Coast and Zimbabwe. Ivory Coast was to West Africa in many ways what Zimbabwe was to Southern Central Africa. It was the great success story. It was the place that everybody looked to and said, its economy is good. It had a mixed economy and one thing and another. And then it had north-south problems. forums. It had and they had elections there where the UN were involved and then Laurent Gbagbo, who lost, wouldn't accept it. And so you then had sort of 4 or 5 months of this, and then finally it became militarized, and eventually, I mean, it was essentially the French who went in and winkled him out of his presidential bunker. And Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, sort of said, let this be a sign to dictators everywhere, blah, blah, blah. And I said, they gave the op-ed the headline, I think it was how to make Mugabe laugh or something like that, because, you know, I said, well, you know, except for Mugabe. We lack some consistency there. It's partly because South Africa's been in the driving seat and we've been happy to delegate, if you like, the Zimbabwe problem to South Africa. But the problem with that is that South Africa hasn't played the role of honest broker. They haven't. They have. I mean, especially under Thabo Mbeki, they in many ways enabled Mugabe. And the reason for that, I think, is twofold. Under Thabo, and this is still the case today, there's one of the reasons is a sort of endemic kind of macro systemic reason, and that is that all of those countries in Southern Africa that fought liberation wars, where the political movements were black nationalist movements that then became militarized and then became the governments, the first incoming incumbent governments, all of those liberation governments are still in power. So from Frelimo in Mozambique to ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe to the MPLA in Angola to SWAPO in Namibia to the ANC in South Africa, they're all still in power. And they all have this revolutionary credibility that, you know, they all play the same card whenever they're faced with opposition movements. They say, you have no legitimacy. We are the people who delivered the vote, the power to the people. And you can see Mugabe, you can see him, you know, looking perplexed at being rejected by his own people. You can almost see him thinking, how can you vote against me? If it wasn't for me, you wouldn't have a vote. You know, that you see how that messianic kind of, you know, psychologically, you can see how it would happen. So that in that sense, it's not in the interest of any one of these liberation governments that any other one of them loses power. It's a bad precedent. What happened when Jacob Zuma came into power, President Zuma in South Africa, was that the Zimbabweans got all excited because Zuma had gone up against Thabo Mbeki as head of the ANC, and critically, the COSATU, the labor movement, the union movement in South Africa, had withdrawn their support from Thabo Mbeki and given it instead to Zuma, and they were responsible for him coming to power. Now, COSATU, the labor movement in South Africa, has been very supportive of the MDC, the opposition in Zimbabwe, who are also, you know, have also morphed out of the labor movement. So naturally, the MDC got all excited when Zuma came to power. But very shortly after he came to power, Zuma fell out with COSATU, the South African labor movement, because they felt that he wasn't doing what he promised to do. And he's replaced them in the, you know, the ANC is a very strange political party. It's really three parties in one. It's got the SACP, the South African Communist Party, as one leg of this tripod. It's got COSATU, the labor movement, as a second, and then it's got the sort of ANC proper as the third. And so now what's happened is that since that sort of bust up, COSATU in South Africa has been contemplating leaving the ANC and setting up shop as an opposition party on its own. I don't think they'll do it, certainly not yet. The time's not ripe. But suddenly for Zuma, the prospect or the precedent of a union movement in Zimbabwe morphing into an opposition and then taking power is a precedent that he doesn't want to, he's not keen on at all. So instead, what the South Africans have been trying to do, which seems to me an exercise in futility, is to sort of rehabilitate ZANU-PF from the inside, is like, you know, sort of create ZANU-PF light, that, you know, and find some technocrat who hasn't got blood on his hands to take over from Mugabe and whatever, but they can still say it's still ZANU-PF, there's still a kind of, you know, a continuity of DNA to, you know, the liberation movement and whatever. But in my view, ZANU-PF is completely unrehabilitatable. And also Mugabe, like many dictators, refuses to groom a successor because that would entail envisaging his own ultimate demise.
And Zuma seems to have reached a point in the last month or so where he's willing to do something?
You know, he has, but he's talked the talk before, and what tends to happen is that whenever the international heat is turned up, he kind of looks like he's getting decisive, and then our attention goes elsewhere, and it sort of, you know, it dribbles away, and nothing's actually done. I mean, the clock is ticking to some extent. There's actually a meeting of the SADC. There's a SADC summit to discuss this in mid 23rd, I think, of May, which may prove decisive. I hope it does. But there may come a point, I think. I mean, Pan-African organizations have not been great at keeping their own leadership honest. I mean, it's, you know, right from the very beginning.
Except for the Côte d'Ivoire.
Well, this is exactly, but and that's a tale of two nations. Insofar as Nigeria in plays the role in West Africa that South Africa plays in Southern Africa, and in Côte d'Ivoire, the Nigerians, as soon as Gbagbo, you know, refused to accept those elections, they were absolutely clear that his continuation was not legitimate, and that Alassane Ouattara was a legitimate leader, and from that moment really. The die was cast there, but in the South Africans haven't played that role. But that was really the Nigerians rather than an institutional thing. I mean, the OAU, which was the first big Pan-African institution, had in its constitution two slightly perplexing things, but understandable for historical reasons. One was the sanctity of colonial borders, which in many respects you could argue are still the wellspring for a lot of endemic African instability. These sort of bizarre, I hesitate to call them nation states that are run along, you know, arbitrary lines, straight lines that, you know, were drawn up at the Congress of Berlin. That was one thing. And also that you couldn't really criticize the internal affairs of another state. I mean, you couldn't, that was beyond its remit. The African Union has a better constitution, in my view. I mean, it gives it slightly more latitude. And it has started to get slightly more muscular but in general, they've proved very weak as multinational institutions go.
All right, what's it going to take to get Mugabe out?
Well, my great fear is that, I mean, there's one big game-changing thing that I've written about in the book. It happens towards the end. I mean, and it has another one in its wake. And one is the influence of the Chinese now. The Chinese have come in, not just to Zimbabwe, but into Africa generally, and they provide a kind of, the Chinese don't really care whether you're democratic or not, or whatever. They're happy to do business with everybody. And before we pat ourselves on the back and get too smug about it, I mean, we are in the international community also very significantly, we bear a significant amount of blame for the number of dictators that arose in Africa in that first generation of leaders. Because if you think about it, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, starts to become independent with Ghana in 1957, in the middle of the Cold War. The Cold War's already there. And from the very beginning, we say to them, as the Soviets, all we really care about is whether you're pro-Soviet or pro-Western. You know, are you on our side or theirs? And that's really our defining, you know, litmus test for whether we like you, whether we're going to give you aid, whether we're going to give you investment, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to support you in the UN or whatever. So for years and years, I mean, literally, we're happy to support rather bloodthirsty dictators like Mobutu in Zaire, now Congo, or Siad Barre in Somalia, who changed sides several times, going to the highest bidder. And we're not fastidious at all about it. In 1990, suddenly the Berlin Wall comes down, and we change the rules of the game completely. So, from 57 to 90, the world is run in a particular way. African leaders find that those are the rules of engagement. In 1990, suddenly we say, oh, no, now you've got to be democratic, transparent, open society, no corruption, but I mean, this whole sort of checklist of stuff. And understandably, you know, there's some perplexity at this sudden change of everything. So, initially, it did destabilize Africa. I mean, in some cases, in a good way, it helped to democratize a bit. But democracy requires, as you know, I mean, a hell of a lot more than just an election. You need all these institutions and civil, you know, you need so many other things in place. Of course, the ironic thing is in Zimbabwe, those things by and large are in place, except for the election bit of the puzzle. That's lastly. But I mean, to answer your question, finally, my worry is, so you've got the Chinese coming in now, who basically, they still play by the, you know, they play by the old rules. They don't really care. In fact, some ways, I think the Chinese prefer dealing with dictatorships because the lines of who you pay off are clearer. You know, who you, you know, there's not, democracies can be messy and they can change and whatever. The other thing is they've discovered what is probably the biggest find of alluvial diamonds in history in eastern Zimbabwe. And alluvial diamonds are astonishing. I'm sure you know that they're basically scattered around on or close to the surface. You don't need to spend millions of dollars in capital, you know, digging down thousands of feet into the ground or whatever. And that money is going straight into ZANU-PF coffers, into the coffers of Mugabe and his main people. And it's suddenly, I think, my worry is that it's revivified ZANU-PF, and it's, in a sense, you know, there is literally this glittering prize. I mean, what had happened before is in a kleptocracy, which is what Zimbabwe had become, if you steal everything and destroy the economy at the same time, eventually you run out of stuff to steal. I mean, you're stealing less and less because there's less and less stuff to steal. And it kind of gets less interesting. But now suddenly there was literally this glittering prize, which I think is, you know, up the stakes. And those diamonds are flying around everywhere. And they're making their way into South Africa. They're all over the place. They're making their way everywhere, except that is into the fiscus. They're not actually going into the government, you know, or having taxes paid on them, or going to contribute towards the salaries of teachers and nurses and doctors and whatever. So that's my worry, that the stakes have been upped in that sense. In my heart of hearts, I can't see why ZANU-PF would ever leave power voluntarily. I just can't see it being. I mean, their original leaders now are mostly very elderly men. Mugabe is 87, and you know, I've tracked the rumors of his imminent demise. Basically, he's about to die every 3 weeks. That's the cycle I've noticed. Every 3 weeks, his prostate cancer has become critical or whatever. I have to say, though, you know, a friend of mine, you know, Mugabe, there's a travel ban and foreign bank account ban on Mugabe and 200 of his sort of top people. That's when we talk about sanctions. Those are the sanctions. They're just a gesture. It's like, you know, poking a bear with a stick. It's enough to make it angry, but not actually ever going to do it any damage. But he is still allowed, as everyone else is, to come to the UN. And it's great fun living in New York, because in every plenary, suddenly there's Castro and Mugabe and all these people who... And what I love is the fact that the CIA spends the rest of the year trying to kill Castro, and then for a week it is responsible for his security and make sure no one else tries to kill him, and then they push him out again. And so it's a very bizarre situation. Anyway, a student of mine emailed me emailed me very excitedly, and he'd been at a particularly... Do you have Duane Reade here? And this, do you know what Duane Reade is? A kind of very down-market pharmacy, you know, drugstore, you know, and there's a subterranean one in East Midtown in Manhattan, just opposite the UN. Anyway, this rather hungover student of mine goes there to get kind of, you know, headache pills or Alka-Seltzer or something, and he looks up, and there's Robert Mugabe, and he sort of rubs his eyes, and they've just been doing these essays on Robert Mugabe, and what is, you know, it really is Robert Mugabe, and he's got a guy with him, his flunky, with a clipboard, and obviously a shopping list, and they're standing in front of this array of lipsticks, and they're going, and the guy's going, what, he's going, Mulberry, something, no, that's not, he's reading the list, and they're both got their reading glasses, and they're trying to peer at it, you know, and Jonathan, the student of mine, is just, you know, and it's so... Of course, you always imagine, like, you know, and that if you, you know, if I had that Robert Mugabe, I'd tell him a thing or two if I had in front. But of course, your social conditioning is such that, you know, when you're actually presented with the opportunity, you think, oh no, be rude, I better not, or, you know, and you sort of scuttle off, you know. So Jonathan scuttles off, and then he says, no, I've got to do something. And he goes back and he kind of composes himself and decides what he's going to do and marches up to Mugabe and starts kind of, you know, saying, you know, telling him what he thinks of him. And because he's, because luckily he's studied these things, but in case you ever are in New York and you're in a situation where a dictator is within your ambit and you want to tell, here are the rules of engagement. So long as you stay back, I think it's 3 feet, don't spit, you know, on them in any way, don't make any sudden movements or appear to be, then it's a free country and you can say what you like, as long as you sort of, you know, you just stay. So that's what you can, anyway, so he does all this, and then he remembers he's got a cell phone, so he takes a picture of Mugabe, and so this is the email sent, arrives describing all this, and I'm amused until I click on the attachment on the photograph, and it's in very bad lighting, it's under neon and whatever. This guy is 87, whatever. He looks like $1 million. Mugabe looks like a man of 50. You know, he has very long life in his DNA. His mother is, I think, 100.
Peter, unfortunately, I can tell you are not going to advise us what way we're going to get Mugabe out or what happens after Mugabe, and so we're going to have to wait for the sequel. Therefore, I want to say thank you very much. I want you to know that the book he wrote, The Fear, is as interesting as his comments tonight. He'll be delighted to sign any copies that you purchase. And I thank you very much for being with us tonight. Thank you very much, Peter Godwin.
Thank you.